Over. Continuation of the visit after the break. After the break, continuation of the visit with Wade and Rick and Mima this Saturday afternoon, 1st July, 72. Now this, we change from Micanopy to the developers. Channel 1 right and Channel 1 over, and a continuation of the visit with Wade and Rick and Mima this Saturday afternoon, the 1st of July, 72. Now this is after the break. And we change to the developers. Channel 1 right. Over. A continuation of the visit with Wade and Rick and Mima this Saturday afternoon, the 1st of July, 72. Bye, 72.
Got somebody I can shake hands with?
Somehow or other, I've got into so much talk the last few days, and I didn't intend to. So that my cells are sort of. We had a remarkable session with Patton, with Burnett. That's remarkable. Oh, he'll be with a man. I can tell you about it. We've got to start sometime on your big operators that you deal with.
I regret that I didn't keep my mind a little more clear about them, being too involved in the business, but I think probably I can pull enough out of it to make sense out of it.
Yeah. Or, you know, we can get a little toehold and see if we can make something out of it. I used to start off with a thesis. But I find that that doesn't, it's dog-eat-dog with them. But I find it's much more interesting to make it concrete. Like one time Miss Daisy was up here, and I wanted to get her back to out of the present, and we're talking about cooking. So I said, Miss Daisy, and she didn't say, you didn't cook like that when you was growing up. I said, Miss Daisy, that stove you had, the table was right square up against it. It's concrete, you see. And she sort of shook herself like a dog. And she says, rightly speaking, my mother didn't have a stove. She cooked in the fireplace.
Got into it.
Yeah. Well, it's something concrete. And I don't know, but what with educated people, it doesn't have some advantage, too. But you see, I can't make a concrete statement about anybody that you know. You see, I would pick up this thing here. They, I can't do it. See, all I could do is make it abstract.
Well, the only way that I can start handling that stuff is to be extremely loose about it.
Yeah.
And when a thought comes in about another person, I just have to run right along with it.
Sure.
And then later on figure out if it has any connection or not.
Now, those fellas in touch with you all the time and waiting for you to give them a lead. Does that take you into anything? That's as concrete as I can get it.
Yeah, I mean, I could work up something. But I mean, you put a question in my mind.
I mean, right on the spontaneous, right now.
Trouble is, it brings up two or three different people.
Yeah.
Or sets of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sort of.
You just pick out one of them. You don't want to be abstract and classified. Just pick up one.
Well, the thing that comes to mind on that is the these men that are supposed to be doing planning, the city of Micanopy. I contacted them, and they're all large firms and operate in a big way, but they know there's money involved in a small place, And so they've got their ears perked up, and they pay a lot of attention when I talk to them. And you talk to them in these terms, about money. And now everything's real quiet, because there's nothing to be done about money in Micanopy because of the council. So he's... it's sort of embarrassing to me, since I knew a good number of these people, and they responded directly to the city and then to me also, a good number of them, in a very nice way, and now I've just got to be quiet. I can't say anything more to them. But if I had the backing of the council just saying, go ahead and work, I could stir up an immense amount of energy. Good Lord, I could pick it up. I can get people to do all kinds of things. And for not much money. I can do it on just advice and get a little bit done here and a little bit there. Out of these various people that I know. Pick it up at a very modest rate.
Now, that's the sort of thing that you can't do yourself. And the people over there, you've got, they don't have any of the, they don't know how to go about it.
They have no knowledge. It's very strange to be in a situation and you think of leadership or anybody with intelligence and you can look the town over and there's no one living in that town who can qualify for this kind of job. It's a broad general job of being the leadership and with some modest amount of intelligence behind it.
For zoning?
Actually, for anything. No one knows about it. There's a Niblock guy that lives there that bothered me, lived with me last about 6 months. Finally had to run him out. He's an architect. He's worked for a large firm. He's in his 30s. But he's getting out of society. He changed his ways. And he could more or less care less about this kind of thing. Matter of fact, I would know more about what to do than he would know. He could do some technical things. But he wouldn't do as good a job as I could do. Where I'd lack would be a lot of technical information. But the putting it together, I can do that better than they can, kind of the conceptual aspect of it. But there's no one in the city proper is capable of passing judgment on any of these functions. They're all extremely biased and think from an exceptionally narrow viewpoint in regards to the overall picture. The people. They can't conceive of the larger picture other than just what's going on within the realm of their yard. For instance, Thomas's confrontation with Wilson. That's about as far as a person can look. And maybe they go around, they see dogs are biting the kids and their junk cars, and that's all they're concerned. Matter of fact,
maybe you could let that drop for a few minutes. We just owned that leg.
The realtor I was with yesterday came up with the right interesting piece of information. He's a very young fellow. He's still going to school. And country boy. His wife's from Micanopy, matter of fact. And he said, you know that this is right pertinent. He said, you know, the local brokers. And brokers are real estate dealers that deal in, they're the head men. They're not salesmen, things like that. Local real estate broker. They're top real estate people dealing large quantities of real estate. Super license, you might say. He said the local brokers can't see what's going on. They're always 3 to 7 years behind what's happening in the development, or land values, or property prices. They're right here, but they can't see it. It's the people from outside that come in. And he said those people have to be here 3 years before the local people realize what the hell's going on. And that's one of those things of being involved in it. So close and never reflecting on it, or never having any stimulus to consider what's happening. There's no reflection on the part of these people. And that it's been to my advantage that I suppose travel has made a difference with me in perspective. And that I've seen different situations happen in different time periods over the last 10 years. And therefore I can look at this one place and know that it's just no way that place is going to stay. Totally different.
And it's so gradual, you don't know it.
The beginnings of it are very gradual. The beginnings of it. But once the ball gets rolling, it becomes very rapid.
Nothing you can do to stop it, too.
No, it just keeps right going.
Let's see. One of your friends, one of your architects, one of your promoters, developers, or somebody like that.
Well, I had a rather strange experience in Tallahassee this week. One of the guys that I've worked with for some time and did a job for him is a large firm. Matter of fact, they were designers of the Union Building here in this university, running around the Duck Pond.
Yeah.
And they can't take all the discredit for it, but the person I would connect with wasn't in on the design of that building. Well, it would have been somewhat better. He's not that bad at design. And he wrote a very nice letter back about planning. There's a lot of good factual information in it. Went over to his house Tuesday night, he and his wife, and somehow got into the talk. I think she brought it up, or something, of this philosophy thing, of Ayn Rand. It was very disturbing. These people are true believers, absolute true believers. And there's no possibility for them to think in the terms that they're thinking them in and function in society in a reliable manner. There's no way possible. They're totally self-centered people. And I've never had an admiration for him, and never really cared for his wife at all. Nothing personal, I just was never struck by her for any one reason or the other. And it's just hard to even talk. It was very, very disturbing, even extremely disturbing. It was a bit of a shock because I'd never thought about it too much before. But here's a person who is, I don't think he's in partnership yet with the firm, but he will be very soon because he's a key man in the firm, 31 years old. And there's no doubt that he'll be a key man in the firm. The firm's a large firm. They're doing a lot of big work. Junior colleges and law buildings and this one down here. And they're going after another college of some description. That's the reason I was over there working to get pictures so they could sell. And for me to consider that this person would be in on problems that involve other people, the particular attitude that he has was disconcerting, and they put me in a very awkward position. I didn't behave probably too well, but it was hard. I felt trapped. They were right in their house, you know, and they come on with this strong, strong egocentric type philosophy, this Ayn Rand thing. Main proposition is you just take care of your own self, and that is it. Everybody else you beat with a stick.
Really?
Yes, sir. It's a bitter, bitter philosophy.
It's strong. Terrible.
It's absolutely strong. And you see, on both sides of the fence, you're dealing with the Micanopy people trying to get something functioning that will enable people to have a bit better world to live in. And then you run into these business people. Now, he's more philosophical about it. I've run into business people who practice this kind of thing. And
preach something else.
Well, they don't even preach at all. They're just straight open, absolutely open about it. There's one time I left a bar in Tampa, and I actually cried halfway home. I got just done in. I'd known this guy in the service, mind you. We were in the service. Been friends in the service. And the thought of how they were acting in the business world, got to talking about it, and I couldn't cope with it.
They knew how to take hold and keep it going.
Yeah. And they'll just, they do that. Do you know that statement you made, that you'd be damned if you'd try to, you'd tell anybody about this understanding that you've gained to let them use it for manipulative purposes?
Yeah.
Well, these people, this happened to be a psychologist who had learned through testing methods how to manipulate people and was selling it as a package deal. Now, my friend wasn't a psychologist. He was a super salesman. And the psychologist had gained this knowledge in the same way that your writing people do in that business English. Gained technical knowledge, perfected the system, packaged it to the point that he could turn it over to this ruthless money person whose only intention was to make enough money that if he fell off of it, he'd break his neck. That's his only goal in life, is to acquire money.
Well, that business thing is that something?
Well, you were referring to it, it led to the ability to manipulate.
Yeah. It enabled you to do it.
I'd like to try to add some of that stuff together, these various experiences with these people. This fellow Don Pooler was quite an experience, especially having known him so long. And I'd go back once in a while to talk to him just to see what he was doing. He was a top real estate salesman in Watertown, New York, and was just making money hand over fist and pulled up stakes and came to Florida. And he was always a big wheel. In the service, he was a big wheel. Oh, man, you know, had a good weight to him, and was always smoking a cigarette, and always, when he wasn't on duty, he was always wearing a coat and tie, always. And he was just a lowly enlisted man, but he wouldn't let the officers get away with him being enlisted man. He was more or less Mr. Pooler to the officers also. And at that time, he was my age or younger, about my age, you know, 21, 22 years old, and he was balding a little bit. Didn't have any college education. He joined Doctors Club in Watertown without even a college education, and that was sort of against the law. See, they all assumed that he was like at least had a doctorate degree somewhere. When he was 22, he'd drive one of these big Buick Rivieras with all the holes in the side. And it was a secondhand car, but it was immaculate. And it's the big man's car, you know, the big businessman's car. As a matter of fact, most of the developers now drive Buick Rivieras for some reason. God knows why. He had one then. And he closed the deal in Watertown, New York, with a doctor on this big doctor's building that he put together and put up. He told me this. He was at the country club where the main doctors were, went out on the porch and they were drinking, and they started kicking each other's shins, and he outkicked the doctor. And so the doctor agreed and signed the paper. You know, that Crystal River project, this is another guy I've known for a long time, Charlie Mayo. Both of these guys are now in Tampa. And they could be peas in the pod. Charlie May would go around and like the buttons would pop off of his, you know, that old funny book character, the buttons would pop off and chicken would eat them all the time. And he was throwing papers at while he was going to school hardly 10 years ago. Throwing papers now, maybe 12 now. And 2 years ago, when I was dealing with him, his financial statement was over $1 million. And we were trying to make some arrangements with him to get in on this Crystal River thing, get his financial statement, and put in some money. You have to always package these things together. Came down to the brass tacks, and you set all this stuff up on paper, and make these agreements, but then on top of that, what the thing is, you have the big man here, and he makes the agreements, you make everything legal, and you have the little man here, so you agree. But at any time, he can pull out a coin and flip this coin. I've yet to get exactly how the process works, but I can just tell it doesn't make any difference to me. It's like he can flip a coin, and then I have to name some terms, the terms that can be met and agreed to. And the point is that there's no way that he can lose in a situation like this, whether he names the terms or I name the terms about selling out or buying out each other, because the little man doesn't have any money. The big man can always buy out, see? Or if it's losing too much money, hell with it. It's not hurting. Flipping a coin in business. We do it all the time. Flipping a coin. That guy is one more person that just I just can't even get close to him now at all. And it's just too much to handle.
So there's no way that you could work with him or get in on the profits.
No. You could be guaranteed. See, I lost, but I didn't lose to any of these characters. A lot of them that I got contacted with, you could be very well guaranteed that everything you brought into it would be bled out of you, and you'd be left standing. So you could write yourself a guarantee when you start talking to them.
Now, how would that work?
They can manipulate you out of it,
yeah,
very easily. One thing is a lot of them have more manipulative knowledge. See, I don't work on manipulation. I just work on, well, this is here and that's there, and let's put it together and do that.
Yeah.
We don't make money doing that. You manipulate.
Yeah.
And they find out how to take our $8,000 in and find the property, and then my development, take the whole thing over and give you a prorated share, and then get you backed into a corner and then pull your $8,000 out from under you. Not only all your work and effort, but your money too. And they'll do it.
Yeah.
And they'll do it legally. And especially if you've got any feelings about you, you're ruined. You are ruined. Because they had the power then, see, I had feelings. And I'd like to see things done that I feel were a positive step, you know, in the environment of the people. Well, all they have to do is get under my skin, and no, we can't do that. And then they do this bloody god-awful deal. So if you're a fool like me, you say, well, I'm not going to have anything to do with that. Well, it's well too bad. Get out. So they ought to force you into being a crook and staying with them, dishonest, just for money. Well, they'll run you out of there.
After you've already put the money in?
Mm-hmm. Yep, they'll take it from you. Mayflower did that with their drivers. It's right neat how they handle it. They'd get these... put out these ads about how you make $18,000-$20,000 a year driving a truck. All you had to do was go to school for 6 weeks, and they'd pay you, I've forgotten, $60 a week, something like that, to do it. And then you bought your own truck. Well, most of that, buying your own truck, was at least $2,000 or $3,000 down payment money. And then you had to run for a while, sort of finance yourself in a way. At least you weren't making any money. Every little bit you had just kept you going. So in the meantime, you also had to make these tractor payments of $300 a month. So they'd take a guy, bring him in, take his $2,000 or $3,000 down on his truck, and then they'd run him around with these poor loads to service their customers. Meantime, they're giving some other drivers really good, heavy, strong loads that they could rack in some money on. They're old-time drivers. But there's always these little things around that need to be taken care of that are money losers. Well, they just take some of these new drivers and then handle them that way for a whole year. At the end of the year, neither did they have any money. They'd made payments on the tractor. See, you own the tractor, so they hadn't been paying for that at all. You've been hauling all of their goods, and at the end of the year, you want to quit. The only thing you're left with is turn that tractor back in, which is $2,000 or $3,000, and nothing to show for it.
And the drivers wouldn't have enough backing to protect themselves.
No, not the least bit of backing. Not at all. And they do this day in, day out. And you talk about several hundred drivers a year. That's a lot of money in Mayflower's pocket. And they do it that way. See, otherwise it'd cost them. if they'd compensate for it. It's a pretty neat trick.
And then they probably turn around and refund you the truck to somebody else. Huh?
Well, yeah, but I mean, then the driver's out of it. No, this Mayflower's out of it, too. They never even own the truck. I go down here downtown and buy my truck.
Oh.
I happened to buy mine from Mayflower. That's a different story. Didn't generally do that. That was my first inkling of business manipulation. Oh, it's a bloodthirsty thing. It's just no consideration at all.
Who has told that story?
The one I just told?
Uh-huh.
That's my experience.
Who has told it?
Oh, truck drivers. They did me the same way. I fared almost all right. I came out after 18 months and had my truck paid for, so I didn't lose it. And I had, I didn't have any money in the bank. No, because I had to borrow money to get back into business next year. About all I did was pay for and repair that truck.
Anybody in print told the story?
I don't know about that particular aspect of it. There's, of course, there's a lot more complaining going on now about business and business practices.
Well, let me see. Now you have too. You've mentioned several interviews. It'll take me a little while to get in that. I think just a little on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's complicated.
You want to get
your babysitter. Yeah. It is late. Yep, get Jack. Jack's a good man.
2-6, that's the
only. Oh, they left in good shape.
We're checking with you.
Okay.
I don't have anything.
All right. Rick?
Good meeting you. I'll probably be over there sometime.
Okay. Come to the town meeting.
Yeah, I think I will. That's going to be, what, Monday night?
Yeah, Monday night, 7:30.
Yes, that's an idea.
Yeah. Whereabouts is that now?
I know
it. Town hall?
Well, see, I don't know Mick and Opie too well.
Well, I guess you better go ahead and read old Jack.
It could be quite a provocative meeting. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Matter of fact, I'm thinking about writing up something. Asking for resignation.
We'll advise with you before you do it.
Bye-bye.
Good to see you. It's been a long time.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Nice to see you later.
I'll see you all later, then.
That's the nicest voting I've heard in a long time.
You know, in that business, that produce manager that I worked with had a head for that. And I remember he used to tell us all about the banking and how when you made a deposit, they wouldn't accredit it until the next day. So that way they had your money like one day and could use it and make money off it and wouldn't have to pay interest till the next day. That's just that small. And this guy was so tight with his money that where he lived, they had a minimum fee on water. Whether you use that much or not, you pay for it. So come the end of the month, he'd get his bill. And it was the same as his neighbors, but he'd use less water than his neighbors because he checked the meters. And he realized he was paying that minimum fee, so he took his hose and turned it on and walked over and watched the meters until it registered the minimum amount. And that's the way he was. And when he'd run that store, he'd run that produce department. We had the end of the fiscal year now in June. And when you come to the end of the year, your last period, they don't figure up what your gross profit is. They just estimate it. So that means you can go ahead and buy a lot of your produce supplies, which cut into your gross profit, and it won't show up. So at the end of the year, he'll just buy from the warehouse maybe three or four times the amount of supplies he needs to run the produce rack, and then it'll never show up on his gross profit. So it's like free merchandise. Then the new fiscal year begins, and he's free and clear.
I didn't quite get that.
Well, you see, your rack makes, you sell the produce, and you make a gross profit. Right? So you make $100. That's, you know, that's real low. But and out of that $100, you've got to take away the loss. You know, you've got produce that goes bad. And that's loss. So that cuts out some. And then you've got to pay for all the trays and the plastic and stuff that you use to wrap the produce up in. See? Well, the more gross profit you get, they give you a bonus on it. The higher the gross profit, the higher your bonus. So they figured, come the end of the year, what he'd do is buy everything he could possibly use for, let's say, the next 2 or 3 months. And it wouldn't show up in his last gross profit, because with the end of the fiscal year coming on, they don't have time to figure out what the gross profit is for the last quarter. So they just estimate it off all the others. So he comes up with his last gross profit, let's say it's maybe $100, and he goes out and he buys maybe five times the amount of supplies he usually does. Well, that would just cut his gross profit to hell. It would just be nothing, and he wouldn't get any bonus, except they don't figure gross profit on that last quarter. So they never know. It's not dishonest. It's not illegal. It's no stealing. But it's just a little trick he learned. Because they never go back and check the figures.
Well, now, how does he come out on it?
Well, they figured his gross profit is going to be an average. Well, it's way below the average that last quarter because he went and spent all that money on the trays. But they don't know. They just pay him for the average. So he gets his usual bonus. Then for the next couple periods, he's using those trays he bought. He doesn't have to buy any. So that sends his gross profit way up.
Oh.
See, it's a sly little trick.
Oh, I see.
See, he just buys ahead of time.
Yeah. Now, that's one of your characters?
Yeah, that was Dave, the produce manager. He was the one who always complained a lot. He was a dog man. He took his vacation on weekends. Right there the last 3 weeks, he'd take a Friday and a Saturday off, and he'd go to the dog shows. And I used to get him talking on dogs, and he would just light up. He wouldn't complain. He wouldn't bitch. He'd almost smile. You know, he had a rather pleasant-looking face when he'd smile a little bit. He'd get that sour expression off his face. But he had some trouble with the shows because some people... yes, in Tampa... You see, with the dogs, you get a championship rating. And once you get a championship rating with a purebred dog, then you set it up for stud fees or for litters. And you can make quite a bit of money off that. Well, what you do is you go from show to show, and you get so many points per show. Until you get enough points, you get a championship rating. Well, this one show, this dentist and his wife had, it was two dogs. One got a championship rating, and one almost got it. Wait a minute. Yeah. They came to the next show, and Dave was there, and they put this champion in the show again. He says, well, there's no point in that. Because first of all, if he gets the points, the championship points, they won't do him any good because he's already got a championship ready. He says, those are points thrown out the window. He says, since this dog's a champion, he's going to take first or second place, and my dog's going to get left out. He says, I may come in fifth or sixth place, and you don't get points unless you come in one through four. So this doctor went to that second show, and sure enough, his dog's all placed and pushed Dave way down the line so he didn't get any points. And Dave looks at him and says, you know, I know that guy. He says, and he's got 11 dogs, and he lives in St. Pete. And he says, and you know, there's a ruling there, you can't have more than two pets, so I'm really tempted just to call on the town council or something and let him know. I just got so tickled. And when they would go to those dog shows, you know, they groom those dogs. He says, they'll come in. He says, you got to get the dog up about 6 in the morning and exercise him a couple hours to get him going, get his mind working. And then you got to groom him. Well, he takes those poodles, and he says, they'll go through and fluff every little hair on those things. He says, then they've got all these sprays. They spray them to get that hair nice and stiff where it'll stand up. He says, I've watched one of these people. They were using Protein 21 and Miss Clairol, and then this one guy was using a special dog spray. And he says, you know, he had a collie.
And he sprayed that cob down and brushed it out so it was just immaculate. And then he looked around, sees nobody's looking, and sprayed his own hair and combed his own hair down with it.
And he told you that?
Yeah. He had an African Terrier, which he was showing, and then a little pup about a few months.
Oh, now he's the produce manager.
Yeah.
And once you get talking about dogs, he could talk.
He'd talk quite a bit.
And it's not all about dogs.
No. See, he's been with that company over 5 or 6 years. Oh, longer than that, I bet. Probably 8. And he's never been a store manager, which is not a really good deal.
He don't want to be.
Oh, he wants it bad. Every time the supervisor come in, he's blunt. He just says, when am I getting out of here? Usually you're tactful with those people. That's the boss. But Dave just says what he thinks. And Holloway would come in and he'd say, you know, I've been on this rack a year now, and he runs the rack well. Holloway says, well, you know, you just have to do a good job and hang in there, which is old cock and bull story. He gives it to him every year when they don't promote him. And then there are rumors that they were going to push him on around and put him assistant manager at a store that was almost all Cuban, which is just giving him the shaft because Dave doesn't get along with Cuban. Henry used to come back and say, Dave, it's your attitude. Because he was short with the people. He wouldn't stop and talk to them. Somebody would come in and they'd want one onion. And he'd have to break open a bag of onions. All right, you got a 3-pound bag at 60 cents. That's 20 cents a pound. He'd weigh up that one onion and he'd weigh it up at 25 cents a pound. And he said, I'm just charging her for having to break this bag open and wrap all my produce. Well, if you want to cut a good gross profit, that's what you have to do. Now, I just give her the onion. I don't care. But not Dave. And somebody'd say, you got any avocado? She says, no. That's it. No. I wouldn't stop to help him a bit. Now, that runs people off.
That's what holds him up.
I think so.
Now, is he the one that did the gross profit?
The gross profit thing? Yeah. He has that way of figures. Stories he used to tell me. He had when we wrap that produce, you got a little green tray, it's made out of paper, and you stack the produce with cherries or whatever it is in there. And you set it on top of this little metal table, and it has a roll of plastic wrapping film underneath. You pull that out, and you flip it over, and then you bring it down towards you, and they got a hot wire there that cuts the plastic. And you set it down on a hot plate, and that makes that plastic stick, and then you stretch the sides tight and tuck them under and set it back on a hot plate, and that's supposed to melt it all together. Well, those hot plates will go up to about 600 degrees. We run them about 250. See. Well, what they used to do, especially in the meat department, because the meat department uses a hotter plate because the wrap they use has more plastic or something in it, and it has to stick better because that meat is gooey. They used to, come lunchtime, they'd turn those plates all the way up and get a steak and put on there and cook it. And he said they'd get a can of peas and open it up and set it down there and put a steak on there. And I'd walk by the meat department and I'd smell. By God, they're cooking something. You walk in there, they got a steak going. Here I am getting cold turkey sandwiches out of the delicatessen department for lunch. These guys back there cooking a full course meal. Of course they never paid for it. See? You just take things off the shelf. Well, that's a bad, bad practice. You can get caught at stealing. They used to go in and take a gallon of milk out, and we'd drink that. And I always felt a little bad about it. If I did it, I'd go pay for it. But they just take a gallon and say, what the hell, it's only a gallon or 2 a week. That's not that much. And there's always those plastic gallons that always one come in with a hole in it. And you can't sell that, so I figured it was okay to drink that. After a while, I just quit fighting and drank it with all of them. But they take those steaks. They always came back and took produce from us. They'd take an onion. Meat department come over and take an onion, a tomato, and a head of lettuce, and they'd break open a couple packages of grapes and eat those, and we say, you know, we're keeping count of this. We're coming over and picking up some sirloins in a couple of days. And they just kind of look at us and laugh. And the meat department's got, they're kind of kings. They don't throw the trash away. They take what they want. They go home early. And there's just nothing you can do about it. The biggest mess, you just can't believe the mess they'll make. And there's nothing you can do about it. Henry would tell me that when he was coming up, and he was stocked, he'd unload the truck in the morning, truck coming at 7, nobody'd be there in the meat department, which meant you had to unload it. Well, you know, you got these big rounds, they call them. It's like the hind leg of a cow. The thing probably weighs 60, 75 pounds, and you've got on good clothes, or your working clothes, and tie, and you've got to pick this thing up, and it's bloody, and it's dripping. So Henry used to take it all and take it out in the parking lot and leave it out there in the middle of the parking lot. And then the meat department come in, and they have to pick it all up and bring it inside, but it would never stop them. It would never stop them. And every store I've been in, the meat department's the same way. I take advantage of it. I leave all our cardboard out, and we've taken it in some time and just throw it all over the floor at night. And they come in the morning, and that place is a mess. Who did this? And I go, well, I don't know. I don't get any rewards. I said, Dean did that, did he? He says, I don't know. I told you, I'm not going to get in that. As I wouldn't take it in and throw it on the floor, because I know it's not going to change anything. They're not going to bail up the cardboard. They're going to leave it out in everybody's way. Dean used to take it and throw it in there. But, it's just privileged people in there. I couldn't believe it. They always come in late.
You know, now, I can't match your story, Rick, but I remember old Cotton. He was my favorite attendant of all the people I've had at service stations since I've been down here.
Mm-hmm.
He was a gas well. And he had a rack. But the rule in all those gas stations is if there's somebody crowded out front, they quit what they're doing.
Yeah.
But that was his job. The service, I think. And I was over there one night, and a nightman was there, and he was supposed to clean up. And he just lit in the cussing. You know what happened? Cotton wouldn't clean up that thing.
Mm-hmm.
He'd just leave it for the other man to clean up.
Really?
Well, the other man was paid to clean it up, but he wouldn't do it. There's a lot of things that go on, aren't there?
Yeah. 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 We had that. See, they usually run a night man. They're supposed to. They'd always do in meat department. They do sometimes the produce on weekends. Running until about 8 o'clock at night. And he'd come in, and we'd leave him all the trimming, all the corn. We got about 55 ears of corn to a cake. And we'd give him about 10 to 15 cases to trim, and then the next day we could wrap it. It didn't take too much time to wrap it. But it took 5 to 10 minutes to trim it. Then you had the garbage cans to carry out and all the things sweep up off the floor. So we usually leave that, and we'd keep a day ahead. And we'd have him trim the celery and all the little things like that. But it was like a two-stage operation. You had to trim it and then wrap it. Well, we had one guy called Kink. He had frizzy blonde hair. It was kinky, like a black person's hair is kinky. And he was supposed to come in about 3:30 and do all the trimming and then work out the potatoes. That was a chore I never liked because you had to rotate them and you'd have maybe 10 or 15 bales. And there's 10 to 20 pounds of bale and you had to pull them all out on the floor and then you had to go through and get the rotten ones. And if God made anything smelly, it's a rotten potato. But Pink was supposed to do all that.
Channel one over, and the end of the visit with Wade and Rick and Mimi this Saturday afternoon, 1st of July, 72. Channel one over, around 700 or 800. And the end of the visit with Wade and Rick and Mimi this Saturday afternoon, 1st of July, 72. Channel one over, around 700 or 800. And the end of the visit with Wade and Rick and Mimi this 1st of July, 72. Channel 1 right. Beginning the visit, the end of the visit with Wade and Rick and Mimi this Saturday afternoon, 1st of July, 72.